The court will proceed to the next case, the United States versus Farner. Mr. Henderson.
Good morning. May it please the court. I think one of the first issues we should address here is what exactly the law is in terms of what a district court can impose as a special condition. Section 3583D places limits on a district court's authority to impose special conditions. In the case of special conditions, there are three factors, three prongs that the special condition must meet to be statutorily authorized. That includes that it's reasonably related to certain 3553A factors. It involves no greater deprivation of liberty than necessary, and that it's consistent with the pertinent policy statements by the Sentencing Commission. That means, in the case of special conditions of supervised release, what the Sentencing Commission has said in the guidelines is, in a sense, mandatory. The district court has to impose a condition that comports with those. So when we get to the two challenge conditions here, I think that one of the disputes between the parties is whether the district court has to actually consider the guidelines or whether the guidelines are merely advisory, as they are in the case of imprisonment sentences. And so our position is that the language of the statute couldn't be clearer. The guidelines are mandatory in this case.
If they're not mandatory, do you lose? Does the court have that much discretion if they're not mandatory?
No. And there are two conditions, and I think you have to do the analysis on both of them. But as to the search condition, under the second factor, that certainly involves a greater deprivation of liberty than necessary. As to the employment condition, again, I think it involves a greater deprivation of liberty. So of the three factors, I think that two and three are particularly implicated in this case. And I think that even if they're advisory, they still have to be consistent. I mean, it doesn't have to be verbatim. It doesn't have to be necessarily even a condition that's by the guidelines. But the guidelines do have an input into this because Congress said they do in 3583D3. I suppose I couldn't have asked for a better lead into this case on the search condition. We've kind of got it ex ante here as to why warrantless, suspicionless searches are a really big deal for...
Where did that condition come from? The government didn't suggest it, right? We know the employment one came from the government, but where did it come from?
My impression is, and this was what we alluded to in a footnote in our reply brief, my impression is that the probation office in the Southern District of Indiana, in particular in this division, includes that as a condition on every single criminal case.
There's a sealed document in our record called Sentencing Recommendations. It's document 29-3. Did you look at that?
Typically, we don't have access to that. If that's the probation officer's recommendation to the district judge.
So on appeal, you don't have access to it?
Well, I certainly haven't seen it.
If the trial lawyer, this was not from your district, but do you know if the trial lawyer saw that document?
I don't. I know that in our district there's been discussion about it. In our district, defense counsel doesn't have access to that. I have seen in the Northern District of Illinois where judges will allow defense counsel to see it. But in the Southern District of Indiana, I'm not sure. And I suppose that would go... to a certain extent, to the standard of review. If defense counsel sees it, maybe they have an opportunity to object.
And I think, if I recall, your brief has something about you've done some study of cases out of this division that showed that 29 out of 30 had this very same condition in it.
Right. 39 out of 42 criminal cases had this condition. I would assume that the other three, I guess I can't make any assumptions, but this to me, this is a standard condition. And I don't think that 3583 warrants it being a standard condition because there's no analysis here. It's not one of the mandatory conditions that's mandated by the statute. And so in each case, you would have to establish a need for a warrantless, suspicionless search condition.
Your client didn't object to this condition.
Right, right.
You can only get it on plain error.
Well, I think that our argument is he didn't have notice that this condition was going to be imposed. And that's, I'm not sure, my impression is that he wouldn't have had access to a recommendation. It wasn't in the pre-sentence report that this condition would be imposed. The district court basically imposed its sentence and then said, do you have any objection? And of course, when Mr. Farmer did say, well, we object to the sentence, they said, well, I've already decided that. I don't think that under Rule 51, you need to make an objection to a sentence that's already been imposed. You don't need to take exception to that. That's why, and this has been examined now in Shannon and in multiple cases as to there's kind of competing case law as to whether we can evaluate this for abuse of discretion or plain error. I think under both, the condition would need to be vacated. But, right, I don't think there was a chance to object. So,
well, this self-employment restriction condition, the government specifically sought that.
Right.
Client's got kind of a mysterious employment history.
Right. I think that the pre-sentence report is a little vague as to what happened. He, at sentencing, explained he sells ads for various sporting events, and I think a few of those sales went wrong, and that's what led to a series of felonies in North Carolina.
And this ad selling is self-employment, right? It's not
right.
Under the supervision of anyone else.
That's my impression, right? And the facts of what exactly his self-employment is, I don't think are necessarily pertinent.
They're fairly suspect, though. I mean, he's only reporting $1,200 worth of income to Social Security over an extended period.
Right.
Yet he's surviving pretty well.
Right. Right. But in order to impose such an onerous condition, I think that's an onerous condition to say you can't be self-employed, you can't pursue whatever employment you want. I think you have to meet the guidelines, 5F1.5, conditions of...
It's a little bit like the judge saying you've got to get a job, you've got to quit hustling for a living.
I suppose. I wouldn't characterize his business as hustling. I can see the government certainly makes that inference from what the pre-sentence report details. But this isn't the type of case where you're kind of hustling or somehow engaged in an unlawful activity. That's my impression of it. But the
it sort of sounds like he was making his living off the books.
I think that'd be a fair inference to make. The problem is, though, that under 5F1.5, a ban on that self-employment has nothing to do with the offense of conviction, which is to say extortionate activities in Indiana, has nothing to do with whether in state court he's been found to have engaged in kind of shady business practices. That's the real problem, is that the condition here, it does not comport at all with what the guidelines require. And, of course, our position that the guidelines are mandatory means that under 3583D3, this is not an authorized condition in this case. And, of course, we've detailed that in the brief.
You know, what are his skills?
Well, I think he's a businessman.
He's not a handyman where you go in and fix things, is he?
No, he's a businessman. He sells.
Yeah, he's a businessman, but his business seems to be, as the court pointed out, he's a con artist. I mean, he's very good at talking people in out of their money.
Well,
that's the self-employment, I think, that concerned the judge. It's a couple pages here in the brief that outlines what the judge is concerned. It says he's got to go get a job where there's going to be some withholding or where he's going to be paying Social Security tax.
Right.
I mean, he was concerned about his future, which I thought was magnanimous.
Right. Well, and I thought that the special conditions 1 and 2 that required some financial accountability, I think that's sufficient to allay any concerns that the district court might have had about, you know, where's the money coming from, where is it going, what are you doing with money.
So the probation officer or whatever is going to look at all that.
It's a special condition.
He's going to have to approve whatever his self-employment's going to be. Is that what you're saying?
Well, probation would have to approve any loans over, I think, $500.
The problem is that where maybe that's you can't do that. If he's going to do something illegal,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to tell anybody other than the people he's trying to con money out of. So I'm not sure that maybe that restriction even doing that. Maybe that's the other part of the argument. Is they would, so what?
Right, right.
Doing good anyway.
Right. Well, the problem would come if probation finds that he is engaging in self-employment, and then
selling tickets
and revokes him. Like right, and he could go back to prison for, I think, up to 2 years. The main really gist of the argument again is that even if we accept the district court's characterization of his past business practices, it's just not related to the offense of conviction. And in order to impose a total ban on self-employment, it's our position that it has to be somewhat connected to the offense of conviction.
Well, I appreciate your argument on that condition. But what about the one on the warrant that searches? I mean, we've got now a six-time felon, right?
Right.
And you wouldn't suggest, would you, Mr. Henderson, that this condition should never be applied?
I do. My first argument would be Congress does not authorize this condition. They authorize, in certain cases, warrantless searches on reasonable suspicion, but they never have authorized warrantless, suspicionless searches of anybody on supervised release. And that's just from the language of 3583.
Do you think it would be allowable where we have a high incidence of recidivism?
I don't think recidivism is the right metric. I think a history of possession of contraband.
So you would want Mr. Walton to, Mr. Farner, excuse me, self-report his financial condition, let's say, quarterly to the probation officer. Is that a condition that you find acceptable with regard to how he operates?
Right. I think special conditions 1 and 2, we haven't objected to those. That's enough accountability. Because if he doesn't comply with that, if probation says we need to see your financial records and he refuses, again, he can be revoked, he can be sent back to prison. So I do think that's enough.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson.
Thank you.
Ms. Jackson.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Sharon Jackson, Assistant United States Attorney from the Southern District of Indiana. Mr. Farmer is a six-time convicted felon.
And so do you know where the sentencing recommendations come from?
I believe they're the confidential recommendations from the probation department to the court. We do not see them.
They're filed under seal. You don't see them?
We don't.
The defendant doesn't see them.
That is correct, Your Honor.
That's a little troubling. The defendant doesn't have a clue what's going to be recommended. Particularly on fairly onerous supervised release conditions.
However, the defendant was put on notice in this case because the court made an oral pronouncement of its intended sentence and specifically told counsel ahead of time that the court was going to announce its intended sentence and that either side would have the opportunity to object to any condition that the court orally announced. And that was exactly done in this case. I direct the court's attention to page 50 of the sentencing transcript where Judge Pratt did that. And then at the conclusion of the entire summary of Judge Pratt's intended sentence, she invited both sides to interject any objections. And the warrantless search provision and condition of supervised release had been announced at that time. And the judge had given her reasons for imposing that condition at that time, and then invited both sides to interpose any objection they had to any part of the sentence.
Of course, there's a lot going on at that point. There's the period of incarceration. There's this employment condition that you inserted and so forth. So the tension gets a little distracted at that point.
Yes, but we also know that there are the fact that probation will go in and do unannounced visits to a defendant while on supervised release or on probation is a pretty standard condition. So the ability to go in and search with either warrantless, suspicionless, or under reasonable suspicion is often imposed. And so it is not a surprise to anyone who practices in those courts that those conditions can be there. But in this particular case, the court announced its intended sentence, specifically told both sides that they'd have an opportunity to object, then invited any objections, and then at the conclusion of the hearing asked one more time, are there any other matters to be addressed, to which the defendant said no. So that's why we argue in our brief and before this court that as to the search condition, the defendant has waived any ability to appeal that.
So is this search condition a standard condition in the Southern District of Indiana?
No, sir. It's a special condition.
So in what instances is it imposed and what instances not?
When the district court determines that exceptional vigilance is needed over a particular defendant, based on what they've seen in the record, they will impose that.
So what in this case indicated that Mr. Walton, was... had a practice of keeping contraband or things that would be subject to the search?
Well, I think we need to go back to the Monteiro case that was decided in 2000.
None of his convictions related to contraband or concealment or something of that nature, did they?
No, but they did deal with fraud and deceit, and I would argue that his extortion conviction, both his instant one and his prior federal extortion, both involved conning someone out of their money.
Right, but not concealing something and doing so. There's nothing in this case that is evidence that he was hiding from his intended victim or anything.
No, there wasn't. But there are other cases in which this particular search provision has been upheld when that has not been at issue either. And in the Monteiro case, where the court was faced with someone who had an 11-year history of fraudulent activity, the district court found that exceptional vigilance was required and that to deter him from going back to his way of life and to provide greater motivation so that he would develop good skills. District courts should have the ability to shape conditions for a particular defendant who has a long history of misbehaving to put greater vigilance on them and to make their life more onerous so that they are better motivated to do this.
I suppose you can put an ankle bracelet on it to know where he goes, too. What would these searches produce in the case of this type of a criminal?
In this particular defendant, we know he used his cell phone to contact people to try and extort money out of them. We also know that when he was on supervised release before his prior extortion conviction, that he had created a false checks showing that he had legitimate income and or purported legitimate income and he was working somewhere, had produced those to his probation officer at the time, and they were fraudulent. All of that is just added pressure on this defendant so that he will live a law-abiding life, because this court specifically found that he had no legitimate source of income for many years, that he could not be trusted, and all of his past attempts of rehabilitation had failed. And so
the probation officer should regularly check his computer, I suppose.
Absolutely.
What about this second condition that's being challenged, the self-employment?
I think that's without doubt appropriate in this matter. With the findings that were made by the district court that his source of income for several years has been from his con artist activity, that she was concerned that he had no legitimate sources of income for the past several years, that he was a six-time convicted felon, all related to either his extortionate acts or frauds, deceits, and theft, and all of his fraud and deceit and theft ones stemmed from his purported self-employment.
Well, is the sense that he will be monitored in some fashion if he's an employee?
Yes.
Rather than an employer, for example? He couldn't hire anybody, could he, to work with him under this condition?
No, he could not. not if he was self-employed. But that is one of the reasons why you have a ban on self-employment, so that there is an independent third person that the probation office can go to say he's showing up every day, he's doing what he's supposed to do, and here are his paychecks. That's something this man has not done for several years.
He hasn't worked for anybody for a while, has he?
I think 2002 was the last time he worked for anyone
Where?
Else. In 2002, at least according to...
2002?
This, yes.
Yeah, well, see, that's the dilemma. Who's going to hire him?
There are programs that abound. Any convicted felon has a difficult time finding a job. But a defendant who has the lengthy history of fraud, deceit, and extortion that this particular defendant has should not be self-employed, because he uses his self-employment to perpetrate crimes. And the court had the task of shaping conditions to fit this particular defendant, and she used her discretion to shape conditions that fit this particular defendant.
So he could actually work for somebody who's, they call him an independent operator. He's just got his own business, and he could be an employee, technically.
Yes.
You know, it's not very regulated. I don't know what business it would be, but it's a dilemma. But I can understand why we have this restriction. It just seems that this guy is not real welcome in anybody's business, especially if he gets near the books, I guess.
Well, he would
Ms. Jackson, would it have been a little more reasonable to say that any limitation on self-employment had to be approved? Just so, I mean, I don't want to be trite, he couldn't operate a lemonade stand under this condition.
If it was owned by someone else, he could be the manager of it, but no, you're right, Your Honor, but...
I mean, I'm just wondering if a condition like this, and I appreciate the point you're making, but it could it not be tailored so that it would leave the possibility that there might just be a situation where he could be a constructive citizen, whether it's collecting junk and selling, I don't know. But, I mean, you get a pre-approval rather than just have the blanket ban.
Well, that is also the beauty of conditions of supervised release, because there is the ability to seek a modification down the road. And if he puts together a business plan that would work and presents it to the probation officer and goes back to the court and asks and says, this is what I want to do, he can seek a modification. So that's some additional protection that is in there. But this is a particular defendant who has shown repeatedly through his past behavior that he cannot be trusted to be out on his own. We ask that the court affirm the sentence.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Mr. Henderson, do you have any time left? Well, you may have another minute, Mr. Henderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be brief. I really have two general observations. The one is, again, our disagreement as to the law. The government said basically the district court should have the ability to fashion whatever conditions it deems necessary, but it's not authorized to. Congress has authorized district courts to impose certain conditions, and the district court has to abide by Congress's mandate. It has to accord with 3583D. The final thing, and this was alluded to a little bit, is the Supreme Court in Johnson talked about supervised release, and they talked about reviewing conditions, and you review them with a consideration to the rehabilitative goals of supervised release. Mr. Farmer is on supervised release right now. He's been released from imprisonment. He served his time. Now is about rehabilitation. It's not about further penalizing him, further subjecting him to harsh deprivations of liberty as exemplified in these two conditions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Henderson. Thank you, Ms. Jackson. The case is taken under advisement. The court